You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Gene Purcell. When President Obama spoke at his second inauguration, he said that the failure to combat global warming would betray our children and future generations.
It's a strong statement, but there's a lot of environmentalists unhappy with President Obama and his record on climate change while he's been focusing on jobs and the economy.
Ryan Lizza is a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. In a recent piece, he suggests that the ultimate test of Obama's resolve on climate change could be his decision on the Keystone XL pipeline. The project needs both presidential and State Department approval.
Ryan Liz is here with us to discuss what the pipeline means to the Obama presidency and environmentalists who backed him in the elections. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's look back at this Keystone XL pipeline. First, give us a reminder of what it is.
Well, the Keystone XL pipeline is an oil pipeline that would take crude oil from Alberta, Canada, right near Calgary, and basically connect it with some existing pipelines, which are also confusingly known as Keystone. And this new leg of the Keystone system would allow Canada to very quickly export about 830,000 barrels a day to the Gulf of Mexico, where there's more refining capacity for oil than any place in the world. So the big problem for the Canadians is they have this major, major oil resource that's essentially landlocked, and they need more pipeline capacity to get it out of Canada, get it refined, and get it on the world market. And the Keystone XL would really solve that problem for them.
And you write that at one point, this was pretty much a done deal. It was just going to happen. How did it go from there to a huge controversy and a question mark at the end of it?
I mean, not just a huge controversy, but probably the biggest environmental issue of the moment, right? It really came about because there was a vacuum in climate change policy after Obama's third year in office. Once Republicans took over the House and increased their margins in the Senate in 2011, Obama really didn't talk about climate change anymore. And his original legislation to deal with climate change, the cap and trade bill, that had died in 2010. In 2011, he was left with a decision to put in place some regulations through the EPA, because he didn't have a legislative solution to deal with carbon pollution, and he didn't do it. And a lot of environmentalists were waiting for him to do something on climate change, either propose some new legislation or move forward with EPA regulations. And basically, people started getting a little antsy and thought, what's going on here? This president is abandoning this issue that he campaigned on. And I think that that's where the Keystone Pipeline, it sort of filled a vacuum. And some smart environmentalists realized a couple of things. One, that this area in Canada known as the oil sands, this issue is so controversial that there's not even a settled name for this place. The government and the industry call it the oil sands. The environmentalists call it the tar sands. There are some climate scientists who look at these sort of unconventional sources of oil. Essentially, this is oil in the ground that's mixed with sand, and you have to get it out. To extract the oil, it takes a lot of energy. So that means more carbon is used to extract it than, say, oil in Saudi Arabia that's just sort of sitting there. And some climate scientists, some very famous ones, said, if we start burning up all the unconventional oil in the world, we are doomed. In fact, James Hansen, a famous climate scientist, said it would be game over for the environment. And so some activists realized, they wanted to do everything they could to slow down the exploitation of the oil sands, and they realized that this pipeline, this Canadian pipeline company TransCanada was proposing, might be a way to slow down the exploitation of the oil sands. And then they learned that, oh, by the way, President Obama has to approve this pipeline, and so a campaign was born to defeat or to get President Obama to not approve the permit from Canada to build this pipeline that would arguably increase the production of the oil sands and contribute to global warming in a much bigger way than if the pipeline wasn't built.
A big part of your piece is spent talking to environmentalists, including some wealthy supporters of President Obama and the Democratic Party. Do they feel conflicted? They support the president. They help get him elected, and yet they're very unhappy with the possibility of Keystone XL, this pipeline, becoming a reality.
Well, one of the situations you have in the Democratic Party is that there's a very wealthy donor class that lives on the coasts, and there's a set of issues that a lot of them have in common, and one of them really is the environment. And so Obama has sort of been used to, when he goes to fundraisers, he is very often, this is the issue he hears the most about. And so one of the fundraisers that I write about is a guy named Tom Steyer. Now, Tom Steyer made a fortune as a running a hedge fund. It's worth between $1 and $2 billion at least. And he sort of recently gave up his hedge fund and is devoting himself full time to politics and full time to the politics of climate change and trying to do something to get the political system to address climate change. And lo and behold, one of his first targets happens to be the president of the United States, the guy who he's raised a lot of money for. To the point where Steyer actually was asked by Nancy Pelosi, the Democratic minority leader of the House of Representatives, to do a fundraiser earlier this year at his house in San Francisco. And Steyer said, you know, I'll do the fundraiser. And he was told that the president was going to come to this fundraiser. He said, I'll do the fundraiser, but I want to turn the fundraiser into essentially a lobbying meeting about Keystone. And he arranged it so he had about himself and his wife and about 10 other very wealthy donors had a private meeting with Obama at this fundraiser where they really pressed him on Keystone and asked him to not approve the pipeline. And so Steyer has sort of, through the help, Steyer is one of many people who care a lot about the environment, care a lot about climate change, who have sort of made Keystone their signature issue.
On the other hand, there's pressure on the jobs and economic front. Republicans, and not just Republicans, have made the case for the pipeline, saying, hey, any energy helps bring fuel costs down, and this will boost jobs at the refineries and along the way. Is that part of what puts the president in a bind here?
It is. You know, there are two arguments on this thing. On the pro pipeline side, there's the jobs argument. I mean, really, the pressure for the pipeline comes from the producers in Canada, the folks who have an incredibly rich resource, right? You know, literally hundreds of millions of barrels of oil in the oil sands of Canada, and they have a problem. They need to get it to market. So that's where the real pressure for the pipeline comes. But as they started to make their argument here in the States, they've pushed this idea that this would lead to a lot of American jobs. This is a big infrastructure project. It's hundreds of miles of laying pipe. On the other side, the environmentalists, their key argument is you have to stop this pipeline because it will significantly contribute to greenhouse gas emissions. Now, there have been a lot of people that have looked at both of these claims, and it's the job of the State Department right now to really sort through the competing claims on each side. And I don't think it's as easy as one thinks to figure out who's right on those, but I tend to think that both sides are exaggerating. In other words, the jobs argument, the last projection the State Department did, basically they argued that long term there would only be a few dozen sort of permanent jobs after an initial burst of activity building the pipeline. You know, it doesn't take a whole lot to sort of maintain it once it's built. On the environmental side, it's very tricky to figure out if you build this pipeline, will it make global warming worse or not? Because the issue all comes down to, will these Canadian oil companies and international oil companies that are exploiting the oil sands, will they be able to get their product to market absent the Keystone XL? And so when you start doing a market analysis and look at the other methods they have available to them, can they ship it to their coasts via other pipelines? Can they ship it to the Gulf coast of the United States via rail, which seems like a promising alternative? Maybe in the end it's all a wash. And from what I've been able to figure out, that's Obama's opinion on this. He has said privately that he thinks the jobs argument is exaggerated, and he thinks the greenhouse gas emissions argument on the Keystone is exaggerated. And it's up to the State Department to sort of sort that out and present the president with some objective numbers about those arguments. And that State Department finding will come out in a matter of weeks, maybe months. Everyone sort of who pays attention to this debate is sort of waiting for it. And then Obama will have that report or be able to use that report to make his final decision on this.
We're talking to Ryan Lizza. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. We're talking about the Keystone XL pipeline. He wrote a big piece about this, about the politics behind it, what environmentalists think, what the Obama administration thinks, and everyone else, too. What do you think? You can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. You can also send an email, talk@WPR.org, or post at our Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
We'll pick up our conversation now with Ryan Lizza. He's Washington correspondent for The New Yorker, wrote a piece on the politics of the Keystone XL pipeline. We'll get to your calls in a few minutes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Send an email to talk@WPR.org. Ryan's with us for about 5 more minutes, and then it'll be your turn to sound off. What do you think of the issue? What are your thoughts and opinions? Ryan, are all environmentalists as hot on this issue as the ones we've been talking about, or are there some scratching their heads and saying, we've got other stuff we should be dealing with, the Keystone Pipeline isn't the big thing we should worry about?
That's a really great question, because it has divided environmentalists, especially early on. The movement was really got off the ground through the efforts of Bill McKibben, a former writer for my magazine, actually, The New Yorker, who left the sort of world of journalism to become a full-time activist and now lives in Vermont. He really started organizing this campaign in an intense way a few years ago. There had been local groups, both in Canada and in Nebraska and other places where the pipeline was along the route of the pipeline, that had been opposed to Keystone, but he really turned it into a major climate change issue. And he, you know, as I said before, he did that at a point when there really wasn't a whole lot going on in climate change policy, and people needed something in the environmental community was looking for something to rally around. But there are people who think that it's far more important to push the Obama administration on aggressive EPA regulations that would do something about power plant emissions and the sort of major domestic sources of greenhouse gas emissions.
Well, let's pursue that, because the EPA just made an announcement related to that in the last couple of weeks, didn't it?
Exactly. And I think, you know, one of the things I tried to do when I was writing the story is push some of the major environmentalists and say, which would you rather have? Would you rather have Keystone killed, or would you rather have these EPA power plant regulations? Now, these regulations haven't been officially written yet, so we don't know how aggressive they're going to be. But there are plenty of people, plenty of environmentalists, who would say that they would rather have the EPA regulations than Keystone. One of the arguments that the environmentalists have about Keystone, the ones that are not sold necessarily on the fact that this will lead that killing Keystone will necessarily lead to a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions, you know, they some of them argue quite persuasively that there's a symbolic benefit to this fight, that if the president were to stand up on the world stage and say, this is not who the United States is as a country. We don't want to be exploiting unconventional oil anymore. And he used it as an opportunity to sort of express how the U.S. sees its own energy future. That there could be a certain benefit to that, and especially as he his presidency ends and he starts to think about a international treaty to address global warming. That's one argument I ran into quite a bit. Including from at least one former senior Obama administration official who wants him to kill Keystone.
You mentioned in your piece, and we mentioned at the outset of our conversation, that President Obama talked about combating climate change in his second inaugural address. How is that playing out in his mind? Not that you can read his mind, but as he looks forward to his legacy on climate change, is the Keystone Pipeline weighing large, these EPA emissions controls, or is he looking for a bigger reverse carbon footprint, I guess?
It's a tough thing to get at, but from what I could tell from the people that know him and know these issues well is that, you know, early in this campaign against Keystone, he was not, certainly not bought into the environmentalists' arguments. And if the decision had been made, say, a year ago, this thing was sort of cruising towards approval. Now, there were some messy politics that got in the way of things in 2012 when Republicans passed some legislation that required the president to make an immediate decision on Keystone. That sort of backfired on the supporters of Keystone because the State Department said, hey, we don't have enough time to review this, so we recommend that the president not approve the permit. And that's what happened. And it sort of took the issue away for the 2012 campaign. What happened after that was that the movement, the activists, used that delay as a real opportunity to sort of build their movement. They did lots of campaigns in front of the White House, including mass arrests, and to the point where now it's going to be much harder for the president, now that the company has submitted a new application, it's going to be a little bit harder for the president to do what he probably wanted to do initially, which is approve the pipeline. So, the activists, I quote one person in the article, a guy named John Podesta, who's a former chief of staff to Bill Clinton and a close White House advisor in this White House. And he is against the Keystone Pipeline. And, you know, he argued that this issue had moved from 90% certainty that Obama would approve the pipeline to about 50-50.
Well, we'll leave it there. Ryan, thank you so much for joining us today.
Hey, thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
That was Ryan Lizza. He's a Washington correspondent for The New Yorker. We've been talking about the Keystone Pipeline proposal with him and the controversy over it. Now it's your turn. You can join in with your thoughts for the next few minutes at 800-642-1234. If you encounter a busy phone line, you can try again, or you can email talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org, or head over to Central Time on WPR on Facebook. We'll go to the phones now. We have Gene calling up from Louisiana. Gene, hi. Welcome to the show.
Yes, sir. How do?
All right. So what do you think about this?
Well, the oil sands out of Canada have actually been coming into this country since 1968. I'm presently working on a project dealing with a pipeline that's been carrying this oil since 1968. It's nothing new. And there are other lines other than the Keystone that are actually carrying this oil now. And have been. The Keystone XL is the north-south portion of it. In 2009, we laid the east-west spurs of this Keystone project, and the idea is not just to carry oil out of Canada, but to also carry oil from the Bakken oil field in North Dakota, which is now being shipped by rail. And by the way, that rail, all the rail cars that derailed in Canada and obliterated that town, that was Bakken oil field oil. That had to be shipped by rail because that's how they have to get it out there.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot, Gene, for calling up and sharing that perspective. We'll go now to Carl. Carl's on the line in Madison. Hi, Carl.
Yes, hello. Thank you for having the program, and I congratulate the author on an excellent article in The New Yorker. I read it, and for anyone who's interested in the history of this issue and why Keystone XL has become such a big symbol, it's a great source to explore. I have to strongly disagree with the last caller. Partly it's the symbolism of if we're going to draw the line somewhere, why not draw it in this case where we have a pipeline that's on the national consciousness. We've got tar sands coming out of Canada that are going to be mucked through an aquifer and to, you know, be shipped internationally. It's not going to make us energy independent. Keystone cannot be built. Carbon in the form of oil and coal and existing corporate reserves would quadruple the warming of the planet. It can't be burned. So it's no longer a political argument any more than the fact that my kids need food to eat and air to breathe is a political argument. You know, folks have been arrested. I'm a member of 350.org. I'm also a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby. And folks have been arrested in Washington and elsewhere all over the country to bring attention to this issue. But now Mother Nature, you know, in various forms, is doing this attention-getting for us. And I strongly suggest that people should really read the science, really understand not just what stone XL wood pipe down south, but what it represents in terms of the direction our country turns toward energy independence through sustainable, clean forms of energy, or back circularly toward a non-sustainable and ultimately, extinction model that we're under now.
All right. Thanks a lot for the call, Carl. Two different perspectives from Gene and Carl there. We've got Steele on the line in Appleton. Hi, Steele.
Hey, everybody. Yeah, I was just curious. For years, there's always been discussions on refineries and the people that live around it on the Texas, Louisiana, Alabama coasts. If Canada has all this oil, why don't they make their own refineries?
Gotcha. That's an interesting question, Steele, and that's something we can pursue on a future show. Thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Lynn with us in Eau Claire. Hi, Lynn.
Good afternoon. And in answer to Steele, my father worked at an oil refinery just south of Chicago on the Kalsay Canal. And they're not benign places. I lost a child. I miscarried due to a chemical spill, and I carry asbestos in my lungs for the rest of my life, as do my siblings. It's not benign. There are dire consequences that individuals pay for so-called cheap energy.
All right. Thanks for the call. Lynn, we've got time for one more call from Ned in Wausau. Ned, hi.
Hi. Among the other things, besides what the earlier caller said from 350.org, in addition to that, the oil from the oil, tar sands oil, is very, very thick, and it requires a lot higher pressure to go through the pipeline. And if that thick oil goes through the proposed new pipeline, the probability of finding a weak seam at a weld along the way is very high, and we don't really have the technology for cleaning up an oil spill with this very, very thick oil. It just doesn't exist.
Gotcha. Thanks a lot to Ned for the call, to all of you for calling in, and to Ryan Lizza of The New Yorker.
Coming up next is the news, and then we'll be back to rate how well the media has been doing with its coverage of the federal government shutdown. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.